morning.
Good morning.
Get your coffee?
I do.
Excellent.
It's half gone, but, you know.
I wait on mine. I'm up a good couple hours before we talk, but I wait, and I make it right before I come down here. Because usually, the first 15 minutes, you're babbling on about something scientific, so it gives time for it to cool.
Ah, yes.
So, quick housekeeping?
Yes, housekeeping.
Thank you to a few more Patreon sponsors, Anders Lindstrom and Aaron Davey. We appreciate your support.
Thank you.
If you don't know about our Patreon page, then this is the first time you've listened because it's all I talk about. It's kind of my new obsession. Thank you for your support. We continue to post some other stuff there and ask, in particular, we've been asking for questions lately, you know, getting some feedback and all that. So if you want us to take you more seriously with your feedback, then you might want to hop onto Patreon with us.
Pay us? Is that what it is? Nice.
Support. Like it's support.
They never support.
They
right.
never use the word pay. No.
That's
no,
true.
Support.
Yeah.
We appreciate
support
your support.
Us, please. Mm-hmm. With money.
So I understand you have some things you want to say.
I do. I have a lot of things I want to say, but everybody knows that.
Well, yes.
What I don't remember what day it was this last week where I sent you an email basically says I effed up.
Yeah, it was like Tuesday, I want to say.
Yeah, and because after editing that last episode with Mark at Mountain View Hops, I was, as I typically do, it takes me about 1.5 to 1.75 times as long to edit the podcast as what the podcast actually is, right? So I get a lot of chances to listen to the same snippet over and over again. And it just was bugging me because I think I vastly oversimplified this topic of photoperiod and light sensitivity in hops. And it could be construed as wrong, a couple of things that I said. So I just thought we ought to clarify it because it's such a hot button topic. So if we could spend a little time sort of clarifying it and deep diving a bit more. Yes, there's actually much deeper to go in the topic of photoperiod. I thought it would we'd be doing a service to our listeners if we did that. So
excellent. And I will point out that we've talked about it before that we try to record a week or two or three even in advance just so we've got some backup. So we're going to put this one right out there and make sure that everyone's clear on photoperiod. So if you hear our podcast next week talking about stuff that sounds like it happened before this one, it's because it did.
It did, yeah. Yep. So these, yeah, I was going to say, it's a unique scenario where these podcasts happen sequentially. So let's talk about it. Mark was asking about his hypothesis on day length extension and why people basically closer to the equator where the days and the nights become closer to equal, if that is a reason why their yields are lacking, because folks have been informed that this day length thing, photoperiod, is a trigger for flowering. And it is absolutely true that day length in hops is a trigger for flowering. Not all plants require a difference in day night throughout its life cycle to flower. Those plants are called day neutral plants. Hops are not day neutral. Hops do require a shift between short day and long day as the season progresses in order to trigger flowering. It is not the only trigger, but it is probably the primary trigger. We know that temperature is important, and we also know, you know, nutrient and production is important. You can't get great yield out of a super stressed plant, right? So let's say all things being equal, this idea of changing in the amount of sunlight a plant gets, duration is what triggers flowering. So there's this concept of short day and long day plants, right? Short day plants say that plants need a certain amount of sunlight shorter than X time to flower. Long day plants need a X amount of light longer than a certain point to flower. So having this talk about whether hops are short day versus long day really doesn't really matter a whole lot, because it's very confusing even to horticulturists as to what type of plant is short day versus long day. Let's just say this.
I was going to say, I hate to even ask, but is that itself variety dependent, or are all hops going to be shorter long day? Or it's more complicated than that, it sounds like.
Well, there is a difference in variety, but all hops are going to want longer days leading up to their flowering period. So that would put hops into basically long day category. And I think I said hops were short day in our previous podcast. So I'll get to your variety thing in a second because, you know, we have to say it depends at least 15 times in a podcast.
So of course we do.
We have this idea that hops require a day length greater than X amount to really trigger flowering. And this has been proven multiple times. Now, here's the kicker. The day length required, the amount of day sunlight, hours of continuous sunlight required to get any given variety to flower can be different by like as much as 4 or 5 hours. That's a lot.
It certainly is.
So you could have some varieties like Fuggle, Saaz, and some of these other noble varieties seem to require shorter duration days. So less sunlight, shorter long days. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Continuous hours of sunlight to flower, somewhere in the, you know, almost 12-hour range. So almost parity with dark hours. But there are other varieties that require up to 16 hours of continuous sunlight. So, you know, if one was growing fairly close to the equator, you're never going to get that, right? You would have to extend the day with light. That's the whole concept here, is folks in the mid-Atlantic region, or even further points further south like Florida, where they're just not likely to get 16 hours of full sunlight a day during the production season. They would want to then try to extend their day length with lights in the field. But
always a but with you.
There's always, yes, I am a but. So too much light is not good either. There's this sweet spot between just enough light and too much light that can actually send the plant into quasi-dormancy. So let's say you take a plant like a Fuggle, a variety like a Fuggle that wants that, let's say 12 hours of sunlight, and you give it 16. It's too much. That plant isn't going to flower. And it isn't going to flower if you give it 10 hours or 9 hours. Damn it, it wants 12 hours of sunlight. And there's a little bit of buffer zone in there. But what happens is you've got these enzymes, these proteins. And these proteins are told to switch on or switch off depending on how much sunlight hits their leaves. So there's two receptors on the plant leaf, phytochrome and cryptochrome. And one measures basically light, one measures dark. They're turned on and off. These sensors send out signals when it's light or when it's dark. And the ratio between the two determines basically how much signal the plant gets to flower. So it's not like an on or off switch. It's sort of like a dimmer switch, right?
Okay.
So you get a little bit too much dark than what the plant wants, and it's still probably going to get some signal to flower, but not nearly as much as if it had enough light. And likewise, if it gets too much light, it goes too far over, it gets too much signal, the plant has a failsafe where it's like, wow, something's really wacky here. I shouldn't flower because this isn't normal.
So that part of it, I guess that's part of where I get confused about having too much light, because it doesn't the plant, to your point, have a failsafe where it says, I have all the light I need, I'm going to close my eyes now and not take in anymore. But it's not that it's taking in too much sunlight and too much nutrition. It's being confused by the day length, is what you're saying.
It's being confused by the day length. Plants have an internal clock, and this internal clock
is important.
You know, it's like our internal clock, right? And what we do know is that if you give humans too much daylight, i.e. if you live in the Arctic Circle, weird things start to happen. We require the circadian rhythm, and it's not well understood as to why this is. And if I sound like I'm not giving super clear answers, it's because frankly, this system in plants is really not well understood at all. You would think that, wow, how do we not know this about plants? I'm like, dude, we know less about plant physiology than we know about human physiology. There's a lot of basic research that still needs to be done. It's just not easily funded because it's not sexy. So given that, yeah, if you give a plant that wants 12 hours of sunlight or 13 hours of sunlight to flower and you give it, you know, 18 hours of sunlight, it's going to freak out. And there's other reasons for potentially why that is I won't get into. But
so to Mark's point, and I know that, you know, this is one of many things that impact what goes on regionally, but given daylight differences in certain regions, this certainly sounds like part of the explanation why certain varieties work in certain places and not in others. Not the whole explanation, but certainly part of it.
I would say that you're correct. That is part of the puzzle, but not the only part of the puzzle.
No, not by any means. I mean, you certainly can't put, well, I'm going to suggest this and someone's going to come up with a way to do it. You certainly can't put a dome over your hop yard and when you hit 12 hours of sunlight, turn it off and go, perfect, now my fuggler are going to be great.
You say that. That recently has been done.
Oh, Lord. Just a big old umbrella.
In a research environment, and I'll touch on a little bit here, but not too much in depth because I want to save that for one of our scientific paper reviews. So that's the idea around day length. And I caution people that are putting lights in their hop yards to extend their day length that they may see very spotty results because of the variety dependency on different photo periods. Mm-hmm. People are going to say, well, James, I have these varieties. What's its photo period? We don't know. We haven't mapped photo period for every variety. Again, that requires controlled, you know, environment studies, that requires money, and this is not sexy. So researchers don't have the dollars to do this. We figure this out by growing different varieties in different locations and seeing what grows well in different places. That's just how this whole thing works. Mm-hmm. And that's going to infuriate people. We have to try it. We have to experiment by doing and sharing that information with each other. The other thing I said is about Mark. I said if there's anything, any truth to photo period being the smoking gun in their hop yields, that night interruption or phototherapy would do the same thing. And that was a vast, vast, vast oversimplification. And I don't want to confuse people by having them go out and flash their headlights on their hop yards at midnight. So I talked about these enzymes, these receptors being switched on and switched off, depending on whether it's light or dark. And you can imagine that if a plant's expecting X number of hours of darkness, right? So their cryptochrome, as it's called, is firing because it's dark out, and you go and you flash light on these things during a dark period, it's going to monkey with those plants, and it's going to basically tell them that they're getting more daylight than they actually did because their cryptochrome is turning off, and by virtue of the cryptochrome turning off, the phytochrome is turning on. Hmm. So it's that signal, right? That ratio between light and dark signal. If your plants are in a photo period, day length, that is proper to its production, right? Let's say it's in its juvenile stage and it's growing vegetatively, and so it's expecting a certain day length. If you go in and start night interrupting that, you are totally going to whack that plant up. Mm-hmm. Because it's saying, wait a minute, my days are way longer than it should be now. Oh my God, what should I do? Likewise, if the plant is close to its optimum and you go in and start night interrupting, and it can be as little as 15 minutes, you can actually screw up that ratio of those two enzymes, and that plant won't flower even though you're interrupting its nighttime period with more light and fooling it into being daytime. It's not that simple.
I remember you mentioning, it might have been during one of the Mark conversations, some farm that you were helping out at, and mm-hmm. there were some issues going on right around their building, and there was a motion sensor light and it was having a, I don't recall if it was helping or hurting, but it was having a direct effect on what was going on.
It was, in this case, it was a very sensitive variety that they were seeing an increase in early flowering because of, you know, in some cases, 30 minutes or more of night interruption that it was getting. Early flowering for a farm in Idaho. So much further north. And so they've got a much, obviously, larger swing in their day-nighttime photo period. So it's real, but I don't want people going out and, like I said, putting their headlights or floodlights in their hop yard without knowing what impact this is going to have, because it will absolutely monkey with your hop plants. I would say before you start trying to do any sort of light therapy or daylight extension, anybody, to really understand the best that you can, because this is complicated, what the plant needs for day length, because that is known. And performing a study, a proper study in your yard to determine what is going to be right for you, as opposed to just stringing a bunch of lights out there and hoping for the best. Because the data that you could get out of it may not tell you anything. It may be so ambiguous because the devil's in the details here that, you know, if you want to do that, why don't you come talk to us first so that we can help put together a proper protocol for you, because there's four more hours worth of stuff we could talk about on this, on the physiology of light sensing in plants that will help determine the protocol, right? So there, I said it.
I'm writing down four more hours.
Four more hours, yeah. That's all you get. You're definitely going to need more coffee.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, this is a really, really complicated topic. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to just gloss over it and say, oh, believe me, I still totally think it's bullshit that people in non-traditional areas are blaming light duration photo period for their poor yields. I don't believe that's true unless you live very close to the equator. I think there's other things involved as well, potentially, as photo period, but there is no one smoking gun for your, you know, potential lack of yield, folks. There, I feel better.
Wow. You got it all out?
I got it all out, all 20 minutes of it.
Well, it certainly is interesting, and, you know, it's dumbing it down from my perspective. this is no different than you mentioned circadian rhythms and getting the right amount of sleep. You get woken up two or three times during the night, it screws with you. Mm-hmm. It absolutely changes things. It's one of those things that, especially, what was me, as we get older, you find that sleep is vitally important and harder to get.
Right. And you know what? Sleep in humans is equally as not understood mm-hmm. as sleep in plants, because it's a very complex physiological state.
I think, you know, most people know the basic, which is that more sleep, better.
Yeah, but like...
But that doesn't translate here, because more light for your plants, more sun, more duration, not necessarily better.
That's correct.
Anyone who's never, you know, who's just a backyard gardener, and I'm not even that, the bias there is, okay, more sunlight, you know, that's, you know... Everything I've learned about plants is that water and sun is how you make them grow. So mm-hmm. more water, more sun. Here we go.
Exactly. And nobody talks about more dark. And some plants are insensitive to day length. And you can have them under lights all the time if you want. And they will grow. And those are day neutral plants. And there's multiple examples of those out there, right? Grass. they just keep going. The crops we think of as horticultural crops do not fall generally into that category. They do require dark periods. They're very sensitive to the changes in photo period throughout the season to help trigger them to go dormant and all that good kind of stuff. So not so simple, gang.
And this is one of those points I started to chuckle when you said they're insensitive to day length, because that's when one of my teenagers would go, well, you're insensitive to day length, Dad.
Uh-huh. They are, yeah. That, was that supposed to be funny?
It was.
Okay.
It was.
Yeah. All right, I'm done yammering. What are you going to talk about?
All right, what am I going to talk about? Well, first I have to tell you a funny story about you.
Which one?
we were again with my teenagers. We were watching some silly TV show the other day, and the husband and wife were trying to figure out what they have in common. And the wife was watching The Bachelor or something, some kind of silly reality TV. And she goes, well, and he's a scientist, the husband. And she goes, well, what are you so into over there? What are you watching on your computer? And he says, and I quote, this documentary on topsoil that has me on the edge of my seat.
Nice.
And I looked at the kids. I said, this is coming up when I record with Uncle James next time.
Yeah. It's funny because it's true.
Uh-huh. I can just see you there with baked chips. Like, oh, what's going to happen next?
Yep.
All right. So let's talk some market. Marketplace. We've talked before about the new brewer, about the Brewers Association, and that even if you're not a grower or not a brewer and you just like this market, joining as a supporter for the Brewers Association is a good thing to do. You get access to a ton of information, and every other month they put out this new brewer magazine, which James and I pore over for fun information, and then we talk about it and chop it to pieces. So this last issue is called the Raw Materials issue, which I know had you salivating.
Yes.
And it's all these World Harvest reports. And on the very cover, it says U.S. hop acreage has doubled since 2012. So there's a bunch of stuff in here. We'll get to other parts of it on later recordings. But I wanted to talk about the World Harvest report that they go over and just what varieties are being focused on and really how quickly that can change. We talk a lot about Cascade and how a few years ago folks were ripping it out of their fields, especially in the Pacific Northwest, because they have the ability to do that and turn things around.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought there was some interesting stuff in here, so just some fact bombs here.
Cool.
108 million pounds harvested in the U.S. in 2019. That is flat with 2018, curiously enough.
I'm not surprised. We could speculate on what's going on there, but I guess that didn't surprise me too much.
There were some weather issues in certain places, but you know, it was considered to be a decent year, not a spectacular year. We didn't see the growth, and especially given that they're putting in more acreage every year, the fact that there wasn't a ton more growth was a little surprising. There are about 59,000 acres in the U.S. Mm-hmm. 57,000 of them are in Washington, Idaho, and Oregon.
Right.
And there's 2,400 acres in the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's what has doubled since 2012, let's be clear. It's the acreage. I don't actually have a number on the pounds harvested. I suspect that has, my guess here, and this is just a guess, is that that's probably more than doubled because we're getting better at it.
Right. I would agree with that.
Yeah. So 59,000 acres in the U.S. We are number one. Woohoo. Germany right behind us at 50,000 acres. And between the U.S. and Germany, that's 3/4 of the world crop.
Right.
So we are, you know, you do the math back. We are 35-40% of the world crop of hops. Again, not shocking. We're very U.S. centric.
Of course. It's yeah. Sorry, guys.
Mm-hmm.
I said, sorry, guys. That's,
yeah, to everyone else who's listening. I will say New Zealand, 2,200 acres, which is the same amount that is grown in the U.S. everywhere outside of the Pacific Northwest. But that's a record for them. They are growing by leaps and bounds.
Well, and that's solely due to our friend Susan
you're right.
Over there at Hops Revolution. So they've single-handedly doubled the production there. So well done, Susan.
So what's interesting here too about the acreage in the U.S. So, you know, 59,000 acres. The top is Citra with 9,000 acres. So think about that. Yeah, I know you're
sorry.
Throwing up a little there.
A little in my throat there.
Citra. So 9,000 acres out of 57,000 acres is the most being grown of a single variety. What that tells you is how many varieties are being used out there.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get deeper into it on a later episode where we talk about the actual usage, the hop usage survey. And, of course, this year, so Centennial's the new number one in use, beating out Cascade. That's, for the first time in forever.
Yeah, that I found very interesting.
Because Cascade, despite all of our talk about it being $2 a pound and all this, it's still your base hop. It's just that there's so much of it out there, probably a lot of it that's several years old, sitting in freezers and still perfectly viable.
Well, but and I'm assuming, too, that did this study, is this strictly, this is just hop and hop product usage. So this could also include extracts?
I suppose, you know what, I don't know. I don't know. There's a lot of talk about brewers and who's using it, so I think they're just talking about processed and whole cone going to brewers. I don't know that extracts are part of this.
Hmm. Because if they're just talking I mean, we should dig into that because it... So the only reason I was thinking of that is the reason we may be seeing Cascade drop is because there is so much in the market and it might be going bad, finally. You know what I mean? So...
Yeah.
That's
a good point.
And Centennial's always been sort of a backup to Cascade. So I wonder if that's where we're seeing the shift, because Cascade or Centennial is not easy for the Pacific Northwest to grow, and it has lower yields than it does in other places, and certainly lower than Cascade. But I find that very interesting.
So that's an interesting point, that Centennial, it's not that it's becoming more popular, it's that Cascade has dropped below it, and what, you know, everything else floats up.
Potentially, I don't know.
Interesting thought. So, you know, Citra being the number one, Cascade's still the number two in terms of what's being grown. And then in terms of the top six I've got in front of me, we've got Citra, Cascade, then Simcoe, Mosaic, Zeus, Centennial. So those top five, Citra, Cascade, Simcoe, Mosaic, and Zeus, make up 50% of the acreage in the U.S.
I'm surprised Zeus is in there.
I was surprised as well.
Huh.
That, and they really glossed over that in the article. They didn't really focus on Zeus. Go ahead.
It's just got to be Alpha. I don't know why else it's in there.
It's odd. It's odd. And maybe they haven't seen a need to jump away from it just yet. You almost never see that listed on beers these days of, you know, hey, it contains Zeus. All these others, you see the names all the time.
Right.
But, you know, I'm looking directly at the article now, and it says Super Alpha Zeus came in fifth. So yeah. they focus on the Alpha there.
Mm-hmm.
So that may be what it is.
Yeah.
Five of the top 10 proprietary varieties.
Yep.
So not surprising, but a note to our listeners who are looking at what to grow and looking at marketplace, there are things you cannot grow, and we say this over and over again. So you need to take that into account when you look at demand. The fact that you have X number of breweries near you that you calculate are going to use X pounds of hops, there's a percentage of that you cannot help them with.
And fairly considerable.
Yes. Yes, quite a bit. I thought this was interesting as well. 7,500 acres of the Pacific Northwest acreage. So 13% of their acreage are what they call baby plants, their first years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a large amount for them to either put in new or tear out and replant 13% of their crop to turn over. But it speaks to changing demand and their willingness to be flexible and shift things out when the market dictates it. So something else, I wanted to read a direct quote here that, you know, it could be, frankly, it could be in our bio on our website, because it's something we talk about all the time for small growers. So I'm going to read this verbatim. Two big issues for growers outside of the Pacific Northwest are the inability to access popular proprietary varieties and the lack of economies of scale. Without considerable price enhancement for local production, it is increasingly difficult for these growers to compete with the large Pacific Northwest family farms that benefit from generations of knowledge and financial investment. So in just a little blurb there, they hit on all the things that we typically talk about, which is, you know, proprietary varieties are an issue, economies of scale are an issue, you don't see a price increase for local production, and you're also, fighting's the wrong word, but you're up against generational knowledge, both in the folks that run the places in the Pacific Northwest, as well as the land itself having those generations of conditioning. all of these things play a factor. I thought it was an elegant way of boiling it all down.
They've been saying that for years, even since when we first got started, and this concept of growing outside of, you know, the major family farm areas growing hops, that, oh, you can't compete. Why even? It was basically, why even try? Mm-hmm. And that, and anybody who knows me, and I think our listeners know me now, that just pisses me off. That makes me more determined to do this. So I think that while that statement is correct in many ways, that doesn't mean that there isn't room for non-traditional growers to grow hops, right? So, but you have to take that insight very seriously. It's one thing to say, I'm going to grow a few acres or, you know, or a hectare or two of hops and supply, certainly outside of the U.S., our friends in Australia, New Zealand, and other parts of the world, South America. And you know what? They don't have any local hop production. So that's a big deal. You know, friends in Brazil and Chile, that is a ripe, ripe opportunity as craft brewing gets bigger. But in the States, I think that's even more of a part of, has to be part of your business plan to say, how am I going to compete? Mm-hmm. Because it's not enough just to grow hops and be local. How are you going to compete? How are you going to sell to brewers where 5 of the top 10 hop varieties are proprietary that you can't grow? How are you going to address your lack of institutional knowledge on how to do this consistently year over year, right? So point well taken, but at the same time, I would say the people that are listening to this podcast tend to be more of the pioneering type. Mm-hmm. And as I told our bankers years ago, I said, hey, when they were asking me, you know, why are you teaching other people how to grow hops? These are your competitors. I said, if it's so easy that they could learn how to grow hops and compete with me in an 8-hour session, I need to find a different industry. So that's all I had to say.
Yeah, I think it's, you're absolutely right. It's a challenge. It's a challenge. And as long as we understand where some of those more understandable bumps exist, and the local thing as well, you know, we've talked about it forever. If you, to your point that the listeners here are the ones up for the challenge, I would say probably also the brewers that listen to us are saying, well, I would pay more for local production because local is important to me. And every brewer is going to say local is important to them. But is it more important to them in volume that the pricing can change?
Right.
One other unrelated to market point that I thought was very interesting in this article to point out, we've spoken before about storage. And not so much the science behind storage, but the market side of it when you are dealing with expectations from your brewers and where are you going to keep your hops? Because just because they said we'll take 500 pounds of X doesn't mean they're going to take it the day after harvest. So there is a, they do inventory reporting as well through the Brewers Association to understand where all of these pounds and pounds and pounds of hops are residing. And over this year, 68% of hops that were, you know, packaged and stored were being held by the growers or by a dealer, some sort of a middleman. Only 32% held by the brewers. And that's a shift toward the growers by 5% from last year. So just underscoring that importance of knowing how you're going to store your crop, because unlike someone like Mark, who told us flat out, hey, I sold my whole crop last year, you need to be prepared to hold on to things and make sure you've got them, you know, well taken care of in terms of temperature and packaging and whatnot. You can't depend on it all immediately getting bought up and out of the closet where you thought you were going to keep it.
As Mark pointed out, you know, he's on very small acreage, mm-hmm. and he's got sub-optimized yield. So when he says, yeah, I sold my whole crop, well, how much is that? You know, if you're on a half an acre, you know, you've got a hell of a lot of difference between a half an acre of legacy production, right, in the Pacific Northwest, and a half an acre in South Georgia. So when people say, yeah, I don't have any problem selling my crop, well, how much do you have? right? What's your yield? And because it's all relative. I that's why I always take pause when these growers say, well, I don't have any storage problems. I always sell all my crop. Okay, well, how much is that? And what is your ambition? Because storage is one of the most expensive endeavors in a hop yard, and one that most people often overlook as they're looking at scaling.
Yep, I know it was one of those things for us that every year the plan had to change.
Mm-hmm.
Every single year. So I thought that was one of the things about these articles, for me at least, is that I read through it and every other paragraph I circle something and say, yep, yep, yep. It's nice. Sometimes these things that are generalizations boiled down to a couple of pages are just that, they're generalizations. But I thought this was a perfect synopsis of all the things that we have seen. It brings the statistics to bear to weigh against the experiences that we've had and the folks that we've dealt with.
Agreed.
So I highly recommend reading New Brewer and getting involved with the Brewers Association. There's good information there. And we'll continue to dive into the raw materials here. I know you were all about the yeast and the terroir and all that stuff in this particular issue.
Yeah, there was a whole article on terroir, I know. And I looked at the people that were writing it, and I was like, oh, I'm going to read this. It's going to be great. And I'm just like, really? It's basically saying, yeah, some varieties of hops that grow in numerous places around the world can have different attributes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Thanks. So it's really not a scientific journal. It's just putting that out there.
You can see that board meeting where, you know, everyone else is picking the articles they want to write. Okay, well, Stanley, you get to write the article about terroir. Oh, do I really? Do I have to?
Yeah. Well, and they're, you know, they're good people, you know, hop industry people from like Barth Haas Group and, you know, all these other folks. But it's, I was hoping for more. I was just hoping for more. As always, yes, I am a button.